Listening Library presents The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier. Read for you by Frank Muller. With an introduction by the author.
Hello, my name is Robert Cormier. As a writer, I'm often asked which novel of mine is my favorite. That's hard to answer. It's like asking a father which child is his favorite. But of all my novels, I have to say that The Chocolate War holds a special place in my life and in my heart. First of all, I discovered the young adult audience with The Chocolate War, and they discovered me. These young readers have changed my life. I didn't know about the existence of the young adult audience when I wrote the novel. Oh, I knew that somewhere someone was writing books for kids. But I didn't know that a separate category of adolescent literature had been developing. I simply wrote The Chocolate War as a novel, with no thought of labels. It was written the way all my novels and short stories have been written. A strong emotion sends me to the typewriter, and the story follows. In this particular case, my son Peter, who was attending a Catholic boys' high school, decided not to sell the chocolates during his school's annual sale. Peter did this as a matter of principle, and my wife and I supported him. He went through that entire sale without selling a single chocolate. Now, he may have had some uncomfortable moments, but nothing traumatic happened to him. But something traumatic happened to me as I realized the potential for disaster. After all, Peter was only 14, a freshman in a new school, in a new city, a school populated with 400 energetic boys. I was worried, apprehensive, scared, in fact. And this assault of emotion sent me to the typewriter to find out the answers to a series of what-if questions. What if? The question that's the key to all my writing. In this case, what if there were peer pressure on Peter to sell those chocolates, or faculty pressure? What if the sale was so vital to the school that it consumed the place? The answers forced me to invent characters to carry out those what-if answers. So Archie Costello was born, and Brother Leon, whom you'll be meeting in a moment or two, and all the others, Obie and Carter, and most of all, Jerry Renault, who might have been my own son, but wasn't. Another thing, The Chocolate War was written in complete innocence and with many doubts on my part. As I wrote, I wondered, who's going to read this thing about boys in a high school involved in a candy sale? But I always trust my instincts when I write, and I kept on filling those pages with people and events. By the last page, The Chocolate War had come into existence, and I began my career as a young adult novelist. I discovered that I enjoyed writing about adolescence, that lacerating, wonderful, terrible time of life. My own children were teenagers, and I saw them living the kind of tragic and, yes, comic life I had lived a generation before. So I began to write a series of novels about adolescence in this big, terrifying world of ours, writing about them but not for them. The pleasures have been abundant. I've enjoyed this audience of young people. Young readers who are sensitive and intelligent and demanding and loyal to the writers they read. It's been wonderful and continues to be. And it all began with The Chocolate War.
1. They murdered him. As he turned to take the ball, a dam burst against the side of his head and a hand grenade shattered his stomach. Engulfed by nausea, he pitched toward the grass. His mouth encountered gravel, and he spat frantically, afraid that some of his teeth had been knocked out. Rising to his feet, he saw the field through drifting gauze, but held on until everything settled into place, like a lens focusing, making the world sharp again, with edges. The second play called for a pass. Fading back, he picked up a decent block and cocked his arm, searching for a receiver. Maybe the tall kid they called the Goober. Suddenly he was caught from behind and whirled violently, a toy boat caught in a whirlpool. Landing on his knees, hugging the ball, he urged himself to ignore the pain that gripped his groin, knowing that it was important to betray no sign of distress, remembering the Goober's advice. Coach is testing you, testing, and he's looking for guts. I've got guts. Jerry murmured, getting up by degrees, careful not to displace any of his bones or sinews. A telephone rang in his ears. Hello, hello, I'm still here. When he moved his lips, he tasted the acid of dirt and grass and gravel. He was aware of the other players around him, helmeted and grotesque, creatures from an unknown world. He had never felt so lonely in his life, abandoned, defenseless. On the third play, he was hit simultaneously by three of them. One, his knees, another, his stomach, a third, his head, the helmet no protection at all. His body seemed to telescope into itself, but all the parts didn't fit. And he was stunned by the knowledge that pain isn't just one thing, it is cunning and various, sharp here and sickening there, burning here and clawing there. He clutched himself as he hit the ground. The ball squirted away. His breath went away. Like the ball, a terrible stillness pervaded him. And then, at the onset of panic, his breath came back again. His lips sprayed wetness, and he was grateful for the sweet, cool air that filled his lungs. But when he tried to get up, his body mutinied against movement. He decided the hell with it. He'd go to sleep, right here, right out on the 50-yard line. The hell with trying out for the team. Screw everything. He was going to sleep. He didn't care anymore.
Renault!
Ridiculous. Someone calling his name.
Renault!
The coach's voice scraped like sandpaper against his ears. He opened his eyes flutteringly.
I'm all right,
he said to nobody in particular, or to his father, maybe. Or the coach. He was unwilling to abandon this lovely lassitude. But he had to, of course. He was sorry to leave the earth, and he was vaguely curious about how he was going to get up with both legs smashed and his skull battered in. He was astonished to find himself on his feet, intact, bobbing like one of those toy novelties dangling from car windows, but erect.
For Christ's sake!
The coach bellowed, his voice juicy with contempt. A spurt of saliva hit Jerry's cheek.
Hey, coach, you spit on me, Jerry protested. Stop the spitting, coach.
What he said aloud was,
I'm all right, coach,
because he was a coward about stuff like that, thinking one thing and saying another, planning one thing and doing another. He had been Peter 1,000 times, and 1,000 cocks had crowed in his lifetime.
How tall are you, Renault?
5'9",
he gasped, still fighting for breath.
Wait!
145.
He said, looking the coach straight in the eye.
Soaking wet, I'll bet,
the coach said sourly.
What the hell you want to play football for? You need more meat on those bones. What the hell you trying to play quarterback for? You'd make a better end, maybe.
The coach looked like an old gangster. Broken nose, a scar on his cheek like a stitched shoestring. He needed a shave, his stubble like slivers of ice. He growled and swore and was merciless. But a hell of a coach, they said. The coach stared at him now, the dark eyes probing, pondering. Jerry hung in there, trying not to sway, trying not to faint.
All right, the coach said in disgust. Show up tomorrow, 3 o'clock sharp, or you're through before you start.
Inhaling the sweet, sharp apple air through his nostrils, he was afraid to open his mouth wide, wary of any movement that was not absolutely essential. He walked tentatively toward the sidelines, listening to the coach barking at the other guys. Suddenly he loved that voice.
Show up tomorrow.
He trudged away from the field, blinking against the afternoon sun, toward the locker room at the gym. His knees were liquid, and his body light as air suddenly.
Know what? He asked himself, a game he played sometimes.
What?
I'm going to make the team.
Dreamer, dreamer.
Not a dream, it's the truth.
As Jerry took another deep breath, a pain appeared. Distant, small, a radar signal of distress. Bleep, I'm here, pain. His feet scuffled through crazy cornflake leaves. A strange happiness invaded him. He knew he'd been massacred by the oncoming players, capsized and dumped humiliatingly on the ground. But he'd survived. He'd gotten to his feet.
You'd make a better end.
Was the coach thinking he might try him at end? Any position, as long as he made the team. The bleep grew larger, localized now, between his ribs on the right side. He thought of his mother and how drugged she was at the end, not recognizing anyone, neither Jerry nor his father. The exhilaration of the moment vanished, and he sought it in vain, like seeking ecstasy's memory an instant after jacking off and encountering only shame and guilt. Nausea began to spread through his stomach, warm and oozy and evil.
Hey,
He called weakly to nobody. Nobody there to listen. He managed to make it back to the school. By the time he had sprawled himself on the floor of the lavatory, his head hanging over the lip of the toilet bowl and the smell of disinfectant stinging his eyeballs, the nausea had passed and the bleep of pain had faded. Sweat moved like small, moist bugs on his forehead, and then without warning he vomited. 2. Obi was bored. Worse than bored, he was disgusted. He was also tired. It seemed he was always tired these days. He went to bed tired, and he woke up tired. He found himself yawning constantly. Most of all, he was tired of Archie. Archie the bastard. The bastard that Obi alternately hated and admired. For instance, at this minute, he hated Archie with a special, burning hate that was part of the boredom and the weariness. Notebook in hand, pencil poised, Obi looked at Archie now with fierce anger, furious at the way Archie sat there in the bleachers, his blonde hair tossing lightly in the breeze, enjoying himself for crying out loud, even though he knew that Obi would be late for work, and yet keeping him here, stalling, killing time. "You're a real bastard," Obi said finally, his frustration erupting like a Coke exploding from a bottle after you shake it. "You know that?" Archie turned and smiled at him benevolently, like a goddamn king passing out favors. "Jesus," Obi said, exasperated.
"Don't swear, Obi," Archie chided. "You'll have to tell it in confession."
"Look who's talking. I don't know how you had the nerve to receive communion at chapel this morning."
"It doesn't take nerve, Obi. When you march down to the rail, you're receiving the body, man. Me, I'm just chewing a wafer they buy by the pound in Worcester."
Obi looked away in disgust.
"And when you say Jesus, you're talking about your leader. But when I say Jesus, I'm talking about a guy who walked the earth for 33 years like any other guy, but caught the imagination of some PR cats. PR for public relations, in case you don't know, Obi."
Obi didn't bother to answer. You couldn't ever win an argument with Archie. He was too quick with the words, especially when he fell into one of his phony hip moods, saying man and cat like he was a swinger, cool, instead of a senior in a lousy little high school like Trinity.
"Come on, Archie, it's getting late,"
Obi said, trying to appeal to Archie's better nature.
"I'm going to get fired one of these days."
"Don't whine, Obi. Besides, you hate the job. You have a subconscious wish to be fired. Then you wouldn't have to stock the shelves anymore, or take crap from customers, or work late Saturday night instead of going to the... what is it you go to? The teenage canteen to drool over all those broads."
Archie was uncanny. How did he know Obi hated the stupid job? How did he know that Obi hated especially those Saturday nights stalking the supermarket canyons while everybody else was at the canteen? "See, I'm doing you a favor. Enough of these late afternoons, and the boss'll say, 'You're all done, Obi, baby, set free.' And you'll have one right in front of him."
"And where'll my money come from?" Obi asked.
Archie waved his hand, signaling that he was tired of the conversation. You could see him physically withdraw, although he was only a foot or two away from Obi on the bleacher bench. The shouts of the fellows from the football field below echoed feebly in the air. Archie's lower lip dropped. That meant he was concentrating, thinking. Obi waited in anticipation, hating the thing in him that made him look at Archie in admiration. The way Archie could turn people on or off. The way he could dazzle you with his brilliance. Those vigil assignments that had made him practically a legend at Trinity. And the way he could disgust you with his cruelties. Those strange, offbeat cruelties of his that had nothing to do with pain or violence but were somehow even worse.
It made Obi uncomfortable to think of that stuff, and he shrugged the thoughts away, waiting for Archie to talk, to say the name. Stanton, Archie said finally, whispering the name, caressing the syllables. I think his first name is Norman.
Right,
Obi said, scrawling the name. Only two more to go. Archie had to come up with 10 names by 4 o'clock, and 8 were now listed on Obi's pad.
The assignment? Obi prodded.
Sidewalk. Obi grinned as he wrote the word. Sidewalk. Such an innocent word. But what Archie could do with simple things like a sidewalk and a kid like Norman Stanton, whom Obi recalled as a blustering, bragging character with wild red hair and eyelids matted with yellow crap.
Hey, Obi, Archie said.
Yeah?
Obi asked on guard. You really gonna be late for work?
I mean, would you really lose your job?
Archie's voice was soft with concern, his eyes gentle with compassion.
That's what baffled everyone about Archie, his changes of mood, the way he could be a wise bastard one minute and a great guy the next. I don't think they'd actually fire me. The guy who owns the place, he's a friend of the family. But I mean, getting there late doesn't, like, help the cause. I'm overdue for a raise, but he's holding it back until I get on the ball.
Archie nodded, all businesslike. All right, we'll wrap it up. We'll get you on the ball. Maybe I ought to assign someone to the store and make life interesting for your boss.
Geez, no,
Obi said quickly. He shivered with dread, realizing how awesome Archie's power really was, which is why you had to stay on the good side of the bastard, buy him Hershey's all the time to satisfy his craving for chocolate. Thank God Archie didn't go in for pot or that stuff. Obi would have had to become a pusher for crying out loud to supply him. Obi was officially the secretary of the vigils, but he knew what the job really demanded. Carter, the president, who was almost as big a bastard as Archie, said, "Keep him happy. When Archie's happy, we're all happy."
Two more names, Archie mused now. He rose and stretched. He was tall and not too heavy. He moved with a subtle rhythm, languidly, the walk of an athlete, although he hated all sports and had nothing but contempt for athletes, particularly football players and boxers, which happened to be Trinity's two major sports. Usually, Archie didn't pick athletes for assignments. He claimed they were too stupid to absorb the delicate shadings, the subtle intricacies involved. Archie disliked violence. Most of his assignments were exercises in the psychological rather than the physical. That's why he got away with so much. The Trinity brothers wanted peace at any price, quiet on the campus, no broken bones. Otherwise, the sky was the limit, which was right up Archie's alley. The kid they call the Goober, Archie said now. Obi wrote down Roland Goubert, Brother Eugene's room. Obi smiled in delicious malice. He liked it when Archie involved the brothers in the assignments. Those were the most daring, of course. And someday Archie would go too far and trip himself up. In the meantime, Brother Eugene would do. He was a peaceful sort, made to order for Archie, naturally. The sun vanished behind floating clouds. Archie brooded, isolating himself again. The wind rose, kicking puffs of dust from the football field. The field needed seeding. The bleachers also needed attention. They sagged, peeling paint like leprosy on the benches. The shadows of the goalposts sprawled on the field like grotesque crosses. Obi shivered.
What the hell do they think I am? Archie asked.
Obi remained silent. The question didn't seem to require an answer. It was as if Archie was talking to himself.
These goddamn assignments, Archie said. Do they think it's easy?
His voice dripped sadness.
And the black box.
Obi yawned. He was tired and uncomfortable. He always yawned and got tired and uncomfortable when he found himself in situations like this, not knowing how to proceed, surprised at the anguish in Archie's voice. Or was Archie putting him on? You never knew about Archie. Obi was grateful when Archie finally shook his head as if warding off an evil spell.
You're not much help, Obi.
I never thought you needed much help, Archie.
Don't you think I'm human, too?
I'm not sure, that's what Obi almost said.
All right, let's finish the damn assignments. One more name.
Obi's pencil was poised.
Who was that kid who left the field a few minutes ago? The one they wiped out.
A kid named Jerry Renault, a freshman, Obi said, flipping through his notebook. He searched the R's for Renault. His notebook was more complete than the school's files. It contained information, carefully coded, about everyone at Trinity, the kind of stuff that couldn't be found in official records.
Here it is. Renault, Jerome E., son of James R., pharmacist at Blake's. The kid's a freshman. Birthday, let's see, he just turned 14. Oh, his mother died last spring. Cancer.
There was more information about courses and records in grammar school and extracurricular activities, but Obi closed the notebook as if he were lowering a coffin lid.
Poor kid, Archie said. Mother's dead. Again, that concern, that compassion in his voice.
Obi nodded. One more name. Who else?
Must be hard on the poor kid.
Right, Obi agreed, impatient.
Know what he needs, Obi? His voice was soft, dreamy, caressing.
What?
Therapy. The terrible word shattered the tenderness in Archie's voice.
Therapy?
Right, put him down.
For crying out loud, Archie. You saw him out there. He's just a skinny kid trying to make the freshman team. Coach will grind him up like hamburger. And his mother's barely cold in the grave. What the hell are you putting him on the list for?
Don't let him fool you, Obi. He's a tough one. Didn't you see him get wiped out down there and still get to his feet?
Tough and stubborn. You should have stayed down on that turf, Obi. That would have been the smart thing to do. Besides, he probably needs something to keep his mind off his poor dead mother.
You're a bastard, Archie. I said it before and I'll say it again.
Put him down.
Ice in the voice, cold as polar regions.
Obi wrote down the name.
Hell, it wasn't his funeral.
Assignment?
I'll think of something.
You've only got till 4, Obi reminded.
The assignment must fit the kid. That's the beauty of it, Obi.
Obi waited a minute or two and couldn't resist asking,
"You running out of ideas, Archie?"
The great Archie Costello running dry, the possibility was staggering to contemplate.
Just being artistic, Obi. It's an art, you know. Take a kid like this, Renault.
Special circumstances.
He fell silent.
Put him down for the chocolates.
Obi wrote down, Renault chocolates.
Archie would never run dry. The chocolates, for instance, were good for a dozen assignments.
Obi looked down at the field where the guys were skirmishing in the shadow of the goalposts.
Sadness seized him.
I should have gone out for football, he thought. He had wanted to. He'd been hot stuff with Pop Warner at St. Joe's. Instead, he had ended up as secretary of the vigils.
Cool. But hell, he couldn't even tell his parents about it.
Now what, Archie?
What?
Life is sad sometimes.
That was one of the great things about Archie. You could say things like that.
Life is shit, Archie said.
The shadows of the goalposts definitely resembled a network of crosses, empty crucifixes.
That's enough symbolism for one day, Obi told himself. If he hurried, he could make the 4 o'clock bus to work.
3.
The girl was heart-wrenchingly, impossibly beautiful. Desire weakened his stomach. A waterfall of blonde hair splashed on her bare shoulders. He studied the photograph surreptitiously and then closed the magazine and put it back where it belonged, on the top shelf. He glanced around to see if he'd been observed. The store owner positively prohibited the reading of magazines, and a sign said, "No buy, no read." But the owner was busy at the far end of the place. Why did he always feel so guilty whenever he looked at Playboy and the other magazines? A lot of guys bought them, passed them around at school, hid them in the covers of notebooks, even resold them. He sometimes saw copies scattered casually on coffee tables in the homes of his friends. He had once bought a girly magazine, paying for it with trembling fingers $1.25, his finances shot down in flames until his next allowance. And he didn't know what to do with the damn thing once it was in his possession. Sneaking it home on the bus, hiding it in the bottom drawer of his room, he was terrified of discovery. Finally, tired of smuggling it into the bathroom for swift perusals and weary of his deceit and haunted by the fear that his mother would find the magazine, Jerry had sneaked it out of the house and dropped it into a catch basin. He listened to it splash dismally below, bidding a wistful farewell to the squandered buck and a quarter. A longing filled him. Would a girl ever love him? The one devastating sorrow he carried within him was the fear that he would die before holding a girl's breast in his hand. Out at the bus stop, Jerry leaned against a telephone pole, body weary, echoing the assault of the football practices. For 3 days, his body had absorbed punishment, but he was still on the roster, luckily. Idly, he watched the people on the common across the street. He saw them every day. They were now part of the scenery, like the Civil War cannon and the World War monuments, the flagpole. Hippies, flower children, street people, drifters, dropouts. Everybody had a different name for them. They came out in the spring and stayed until October, hanging around, calling taunts to passers-by occasionally, but most of the time quiet, languid, and peaceful. He was fascinated by them and sometimes envied their old clothes, their sloppiness, the way they didn't seem to give a damn about anything. Trinity was one of the last schools to retain a dress code, shirt and tie. He watched a cloud of smoke swirl around a girl in a floppy hat. Grass? He didn't know. A lot of things he didn't know. Absorbed in his thoughts, he didn't notice that one of the street people had detached himself from the others and was crossing the street, dodging cars deftly. "Hey, man!" Startled, Jerry realized the guy was addressing him. "Me?" The fellow stood in the street, on the other side of a green Volkswagen, his chest resting on the car's roof. "Yes, you." He was about 19, long black hair brushing his shoulders, a curling mustache like a limp black snake draped on his upper lip, the ends dangling near his chin. "You've been staring at us, man, like every day, standing here and staring." They really say man, Jerry thought. He didn't think anybody said man anymore, except as a joke, but this guy wasn't joking. "Hey, man, you think we're in a zoo? That why you stare?" "No, look, I don't stare." But he did stare every day. "Yes, you do, man. You stand here and look at us, with your homework books and your nice shirt and your blue and white tie." Jerry looked around uneasily. He confronted only strangers, nobody from school. "We're not subhumans, man." "I didn't say you were, but you look it." "Look," Jerry said, "I've got to get my bus," which was ridiculous, of course, because the bus wasn't in sight. "You know who's subhuman, man? You. You are. Going to school every day and back home on the bus.
and do your homework. The guy's voice was contemptuous. Square boy. Middle-aged at 14, 15, already caught in a routine. Wow.
A hiss and the stench of exhaust announced the arrival of the bus. Jerry swung away from the guy.
Go get your bus, square boy, he called. Don't miss the bus, boy. You're missing a lot of things in the world. Better not miss that bus.
Jerry walked to the bus like a sleepwalker. He hated confrontations. His heart hammered. He climbed aboard, dropped his token in the coin box, and lurched to his seat as the bus moved away from the curb. He sat down, breathed deeply, closed his eyes.
Go get your bus, square boy!
He opened his eyes and slitted them against the invasion of the sun through the window.
You're missing a lot of things in the world. Better not miss that bus.
A big put-on, of course. That was their specialty, people like that, putting people on. Nothing else to do with their lives, piddling away their lives. And yet, what? He didn't know. He thought of his life, going to school and coming home. Even though his tie was loose, dangling on his shirt, he yanked it off. He looked up at the advertising placards above the windows, wanting to turn his thoughts away from the confrontation. Why? Someone had scrawled in a blank space no advertiser had rented. Why not? Someone else had slashed in answer. Jerry closed his eyes, exhausted suddenly. And it seemed like too much of an effort even to think. 4. How many boxes?
20,000.
Archie whistled in astonishment. He usually didn't blow his cool that easily, particularly with someone like Brother Leon. But the image of 20,000 boxes of chocolates being delivered here to Trinity was ridiculous. Then he saw the mustache of moistness on Brother Leon's upper lip, the watery eyes and the dampness on his forehead. Something clicked. This wasn't the calm and deadly Leon who could hold a class in the palm of his hand. This was someone riddled with cracks and crevices. Archie became absolutely still, afraid that the rapid beating of his heart might betray his sudden knowledge, the proof of what he'd always suspected, not only of Brother Leon, but most grown-ups, most adults. They were vulnerable, running scared, open to invasion.
I know that's a lot of chocolates, Brother Leon admitted, managing to keep his voice casual, for which Archie admired him.
A smart one, Leon, hard to pin down. Even though he was sweating like a madman, his voice remained calm, reasoned.
But we have tradition working in our favor. The chocolate sale is an annual event. The boys have come to expect it. If they can sell 10,000 boxes of chocolates in other years, why not 20,000 this year? And these are special chocolates, Archie. High profit. A special deal.
How is it special? Archie asked, pressing his advantage. None of that student talking to teacher crap in his voice. He was here in Leon's office by special invitation. Let Leon talk to the real Archie, not the kid who sat in his algebra class.
Actually, these are Mother's Day chocolates. I was able to pick them up at a bargain price. Beautiful boxes, gift boxes, and in perfect condition. They've been stored under the best of conditions since last spring. All we have to do is remove the purple ribbons that say Mother, and we're in business. We can sell them for $2 a box and make a profit of almost $1 on each one.
But 20,000 boxes? Archie performed some quick calculations, although he wasn't a whiz at math.
We're about 400 guys in the school. That means everybody's got to sell 50 boxes. Usually the guys have a quota of 25 boxes each to sell, and the price is $1, he sighed. Now everything is doubled. That's a lot of selling for this school, Brother Leon, for any school.
I know that, Archie. But Trinity is special, isn't it? If I didn't think the boys of Trinity could do it, do you think I would take a risk? Aren't we capable of what others aren't?
Bullshit, was what Archie thought. I know what you're wondering, Archie. Why am I burdening you with this problem? Archie, in fact, was wondering why Brother Leon had laid his plans before him. He had never been particularly friendly with Leon or any other Trinity teacher. And Leon was a special breed. On the surface, he was one of those pale, ingratiating kind of men who tiptoed through life on small, quick feet. He looked like a henpecked husband, a pushover, a sucker. He was the assistant headmaster of the school, but actually served as a flunky for the head, like an errand boy. But all this was deceptive. In the classroom, Leon was another person altogether, smirking, sarcastic, his thin, high voice venomous. He could hold your attention like a cobra. Instead of fangs, he used his teacher's pointer, flicking out here, there, everywhere. He watched the class like a hawk, suspicious, searching out cheaters or daydreamers, probing for weaknesses in the students and then exploiting those weaknesses. He had never taken on Archie. Not yet.
"Let me paint you the picture," Leon said, leaning forward in his chair. "All private schools, Catholic or otherwise, are struggling these days. Many are closing down. Prices are going up, and we have only so many sources of income. As you know, Archie, we're not one of those exclusive boarding schools. And we don't have any wealthy alumni to draw on. We're a day school dedicated to preparing young men from middle-class homes for college. There are no rich men's sons here. Take yourself, for instance. Your father operates an insurance agency. He makes a good salary, but he's hardly wealthy, is he? Take Tommy Desjardins. His father's a dentist. Very well off, they have two cars, a summer home. And that's about tops for the parents of Trinity boys." He held up his hand. "I'm not trying to put down the parents." Archie winced. It irritated him when grown-ups resorted to student language like put down. "What I'm saying, Archie, is that the parents are mostly in modest circumstances and can't absorb any more tuition increases. We have to find revenue wherever possible. Football barely pays for itself. We haven't had a winning season for 3 years. The interest in boxing has fallen off now that television doesn't feature boxing anymore." Archie stifled a yawn. "So what else was new?" "I'm putting my cards on the table, Archie, to show you, to impress upon you, how we have to tap every source of income. How even a chocolate sale can be vital and important to us." Silence fell. The school was hushed around them, so hushed that Archie wondered whether the office was soundproof. Classes were over for the day, of course, but that was the time when a lot of other action got started, particularly vigil action. "Another thing," Leon went on. "We've kept this quiet, but the head is ill, perhaps seriously so. He's scheduled to enter the hospital tomorrow. Tests and things. The outlook isn't good."
Archie waited for Leon to get to the point. Was he going to make a ridiculous pitch for the chocolate sale to be a success in honor of the sick headmaster? Win one for the Gipper like some pukey late-night movie?
"He may be incapacitated for weeks."
"That's rough. So what?"
"Which means the school will be in my charge. The school will be my responsibility."
The silence again. But this time Archie felt a waiting in the silence. He had a feeling that Leon was about to make his point.
"I need your help, Archie."
"My help?" Archie asked, feigning surprise, trying to keep any trace of mockery out of his voice. He knew now why he was here. Leon didn't mean Archie's help. He meant the help of the vigils, and didn't dare put it into words. No one was allowed to breathe a word about the vigils. Officially, the vigils did not exist. How could a school condone an organization like the vigils? The school allowed it to function by ignoring it completely, pretending it wasn't there. But it was there, all right, Archie thought bitterly. It was there because it served a purpose. The vigils kept things under control. Without the vigils, Trinity might have been torn apart, like other schools had been, by demonstrations, protests, all that crap. Archie was surprised by Leon's audacity, knowing his connection with the vigils and bringing him in here this way. "But how can I help?" Archie asked, turning the screw, emphasizing the singular of himself and not the plural of the vigils. "By getting behind the sale. As you said, Archie, 20,000 boxes, that's a lot of chocolates." "The price is doubled, too," Archie reminded him, enjoying himself now. $2 a box instead of one. "But we need that money desperately. How about the bonus? The school always gives the boys a bonus." "As usual, Archie. A day off from school when every chocolate has been sold." "No free trip this year? Last year we were taken to Boston to a stage show." Archie didn't care about the trip, but he enjoyed this reverse position, himself asking the questions and Leon squirming, so different from the classroom. "I'll think of something as a substitute," Leon said. Archie let the silence stretch. "Can I count on you, Archie?" Leon's forehead was damp again. Archie decided to plunge, to see how far he could go. "But what can I do? I'm just one guy." "You have influence, Archie." "Influence?" Archie's voice was coming out loud and clear. He was cool, in command. Let Leon sweat. Archie was sweet and cool. "I'm not a class officer. I'm not a member of the student council. Christ, if only the guys were here to see him. I don't even make the honor roll." Suddenly, Leon wasn't sweating anymore. The beads of perspiration still danced on his forehead, but he had become stiff and cold. Archie could feel the coldness, more than cold, an icy hate coming across the desk, like a deadly ray from some bleak and lethal planet. "Have I gone too far?" he wondered. "I've got this guy for algebra, my weakest subject." "You know what I mean," Leon said, his voice like a door slamming. Their eyes met, held. A showdown now, at this moment? Would that be the smart thing to do? Archie believed in always doing the smart thing. Not the thing you ached to do, not the impulsive act, but the thing that would pay off later. That's why he was the assigner. That's why the vigils depended on him. Hell, the vigils were the school, and he, Archie Costello, was the vigils. That's why Leon had called him here. That's why Leon was practically begging for his help. Archie suddenly had a terrific craving for a Hershey. "I know what you mean," Archie said, postponing the showdown. Leon could be like money in the bank for future use. "You'll help then?" "I'll check with them," Archie said, letting them hang in the air. And it hung. Leon didn't pick it up. Neither did Archie. They looked at each other for a long moment. "The vigils will help," Archie said, unable to contain himself any longer. He had never been able to use those words, the vigils, aloud to a teacher, had to deny the existence of the organization for so long that it was beautiful to use them, to see the surprise on Leon's pale, perspiring face. Then he pushed back his chair and left the office without waiting for the teacher's dismissal. 5. "Your name is Goubert?"
"Yes."
"They call you the Goober?"
"Yes."
"Yes what?" Archie was disgusted with himself even as he said it. "Yes what?" Like a scene from out of an old World War II movie. But the kid Goubert stammered and then said, "Yes sir," like a raw recruit.
Know why you're here, Goober?
The Goober hesitated. Despite his height, he was easily 6'1". He reminded Archie of a child, someone who didn't belong here, as if he'd been caught sneaking into an adults-only movie. He was too skinny, of course, and he had the look of a loser, vigil bait.
Yes, sir, the Goober finally said.
Archie was always puzzled about whatever there was inside of him that enjoyed these performances, toying with kids, leading them on, humiliating them, finally. He'd earned the job of a signer because of his quick mind, his swift intelligence, his fertile imagination, his ability to see two moves ahead as if life were a giant checker or chess game. But something more than that, something nobody could find words to describe. Archie knew what it was and recognized it, although it eluded a definition. One night while watching an old Marx Brothers movie on The Late Show, he was held entranced by a scene where the brothers were searching for a missing painting. Groucho said, "We'll search every room in the house," Chico asked. "But what if it ain't in the house?" Groucho replied, "Then we'll search the house next door." "What if there ain't no house next door?" And Groucho, "Then we'll build one." And they immediately started to draw up plans for building the house. That's what Archie did. Built the house nobody could anticipate a need for except himself. A house that was invisible to everyone else. "If you know, then tell me why you're here, Goober," Archie said now, his voice gentle. He always treated them with tenderness, as if a bond existed between them. Someone snickered. Archie stiffened, shot a look at Carter, a withering look that said, "Tell them to cut the crap." Carter snapped his fingers, which sounded in the quiet storage room like the banging of a gavel. The vigils were grouped, as usual, in a circle around Archie and the kid receiving the assignment. The small room behind the gym was windowless, with only one door leading to the gymnasium itself, a perfect spot for vigil meetings, private. The solitary entrance, easily guarded and dim, lit by a single bulb dangling from the ceiling, a 40-watt bulb that bestowed only a feeble light on the proceedings. The silence was deafening after the snap of Carter's fingers. Nobody fooled around with Carter. Carter was the president of the vigils, because the president was always a football player, the muscle someone like Archie needed. But everyone knew that the head of the vigils was the assigner, Archie Costello, who was always one step ahead of them all. The Goober looked frightened. He was one of those kids who always wanted to please everybody. The guy who never got the girl but worshipped her in secret while the big shot hero rode off in the sunset with her in the end. "Tell me," Archie said, "why you're here." He allowed a bit of impatience to appear in his voice. "For an assignment." "Do you realize that there's nothing personal in the assignment?" The Goober nodded. "That this is tradition here at Trinity?" "Yes." "And that you must pledge silence?" "Yes," the Goober said, swallowing, his Adam's apple doing a dance in that long, thin neck. Silence. Archie let it gather. He could feel a heightening of interest in the room. It always happened this way when an assignment was about to be given. He knew what they were thinking. What's Archie come up with this time? Sometimes Archie resented them. The members of the vigils did nothing but enforce the rules. Carter was muscle and Obi an errand boy. Archie alone was always under pressure, devising the assignments, working them out, as if he was some kind of machine. Press a button, out comes an assignment. What did they know about the agonies of it all? The nights he tossed and turned, the times he felt used up, empty. And yet he couldn't deny that he exulted in moments like this. The guys leaning forward in anticipation, the mystery that surrounded them all, the kid Goober, white-faced and frightened, the place so quiet you could almost hear your own heartbeat. And all eyes on him, Archie. "Goober?"
"Yes? Yes, sir?"
"Swallow. Know what a screwdriver is?"
"Yes."
"Can you put your hands on one?"
"Yes, yes, sir. My father, he has a tool chest."
"Fine. Know what they use Screwdrivers for, Goober?
Yes.
What for?
To screw things. I mean, to put screws into things.
Someone laughed, and Archie let it pass, a relief to the tension. And also, Goober, Archie said, a screwdriver takes screws out of things, right?
Yes, sir.
A screwdriver then can loosen as well as tighten, right?
Right,
the Goober said, nodding his head, eager, his attention fastened on the thought of the screwdriver, almost as if he were hypnotized. And Archie was carried on marvelous waves of power and glory, leading the Goober toward the ultimate destination, feeding him the information little by little, the best part of the lousy job. Not really lousy, though. Great, in fact. Beautiful, in fact. Worth all the sweat. Now, do you know where Brother Eugene's homeroom is located? The anticipation in the air was almost visible at this moment, blazing, electric.
Yes, room 19, second floor.
Right, Archie said, as if giving the Goober an A for recitation. Next Thursday afternoon, you'll make arrangements to be free. Afternoon, evening, all night, if necessary. The Goober stood there, spellbound. The school will be deserted. The brothers, most of them the ones who count, will be off to a conference at provincial headquarters in Maine. The janitor is taking a day off. There'll be no one in the building after 3 in the afternoon. No one but you, Goober. You and your screwdriver. Now the final moment, the climax, almost like coming. And here's what you do, Goober. Pause. You loosen.
Loosen?
The Adam's apple dancing. Loosen. Archie waited a beat, in strict command of the room, the silence almost unbearable, and said, "Everything in Brother Eugene's room is held together by screws. The chairs, the desks, the blackboards. Now, with your little screwdriver, maybe you'd better bring along various and assorted sizes, just in case, you start to loosen. Don't take out the screws, just loosen them until they reach that point where they're almost ready to fall out. Everything hanging there by a thread." A howl of delight came from the guys. Probably Obi, who had gotten the picture, who could see the house that Archie was building, the house that didn't exist until he built it in their minds. Then others joined in the laughter as they envisioned the result of the assignment. Archie let himself be caressed by the laughter of admiration, knowing that he'd scored again. They were always waiting for him to fail, to fall flat on his face. But he'd scored once more.
"Geez," the Goober said, "that's going to take a lot of work. There's a lot of desks and chairs in there."
"You'll have all night. We guarantee you won't be disturbed."
"Geez."
The Adam's apple was positively convulsive now. "Thursday," Archie said, a command in his voice, no nonsense, final, irrevocable. The Goober nodded, accepting the assignment like a sentence of doom, the way all the others did, knowing there was no way out, no reprieve, no appeal. The law of the vigils was final. Everyone at Trinity knew that. Somebody whispered, "Wow!" Carter snapped his fingers again, and tension quickly built up in the room once more. But a different kind of tension. Tension with teeth in it. For Archie. He braced himself. Reaching under the abandoned teacher's desk he sat behind as presiding officer, Carter pulled out a small black box. He shook it, and the sound of marbles could be heard clicking together inside. Obi came forward holding a key in his hand. Was that a smile on Obi's face? Archie couldn't be sure. He wondered, does Obi really hate me? Do they all hate me? Not that it mattered, not while Archie held the power. He would conquer all, even the black box. Carter took the key from Obi and held it up. "Ready?" he asked Archie.
Ready? Archie said, keeping his face expressionless, inscrutable as usual, even though he felt a bead of perspiration trace a cold path from his armpit to his rib. The black box was his nemesis. It contained 6 marbles, 5 of them white and 1 of them black. It was an ingenious idea thought up by someone long before Archie's time, someone who was wise enough or a bastard enough to realize that an assigner could go off the deep end if there wasn't some kind of control. The box provided the control. After every assignment, it was presented to Archie. If Archie drew a white marble, the assignment stood as ordered. If Archie drew the black marble, it would be necessary for Archie himself to carry out the assignment, to perform the duty he had assigned for others. He had beaten the black box for 3 years. Could he do it again? Or was his luck running out? Would the law of averages catch up to him? A tremor ran along his arm as he extended his hand toward the box. He hoped no one had noticed. Reaching inside, he grabbed a marble, concealed it in the palm of his hand. He withdrew his hand, held the arm straight out, calmly now, without shiver or tremor. He opened his hand. The marble was white. The corner of Archie's mouth twitched as the tension of his body relaxed. He had beaten them again. He had won again. I am Archie. I cannot lose. Carter snapped his fingers and the meeting began to break up. Suddenly, Archie felt empty, used up, discarded. He looked at the kid, Goober, who stood there in bewilderment, looking as if he were going to cry. Archie almost felt sorry for the kid. Almost, but not quite. 6. Brother Leon was getting ready to put on his show. Jerry knew the symptoms, all the guys knew them. Most of them were freshmen and had been in Leon's class only a month or so, but the teacher's pattern had already emerged. First, Leon gave them a reading assignment. Then he'd pace up and down, restless, sighing, wandering through the aisles, the blackboard pointer poised in his hand, the pointer he used either like a conductor's baton or a musketeer's sword. He'd use the tip to push around a book on a desk or to flick a kid's necktie, scratching gently down some guy's back, poking the pointer as if he were a rubbish collector picking his way through the debris of the classroom. One day the pointer had rested on Jerry's head for a moment and then passed on. Unaccountably, Jerry had shivered as if he had just escaped some terrible fate. Now, aware of Leon prowling ceaselessly around the classroom, Jerry kept his eyes on paper, although he didn't feel like reading. 2 more periods. He looked forward to football practice. After days of calisthenics, the coach had said that probably he'd let them use the ball this afternoon. "Enough of this crap." That was Brother Leon, always trying to shock, using words like crap and bull and slipping in a few damns and hells once in a while. Actually, he did shock, maybe because his words were so startling as they issued from this pale and inoffensive-looking little man. Later on, you found out that he wasn't inoffensive, of course. Now everyone looked up at Leon as that word, crap, echoed in the room. 10 minutes left. Time enough for Leon to perform, to play one of his games. The class looked at him in a kind of horrible fascination. The brother's glance went slowly around the room, like the ray of a lighthouse sweeping a familiar coast, searching for hidden defects. Jerry felt a sense of dread and anticipation, both at the same time. "Bailey," Leon said.
"Yes, Brother Leon?"
Leon would pick Bailey. One of the weak kids, high honor student, but shy, introverted, always reading, his eyes red-rimmed behind the glasses. "Up here," Leon said, finger beckoning. Bailey went quietly to the front of the room. Jerry could see a vein throbbing in the boy's temple. "As you know, gentlemen," Brother Leon began, addressing the class directly and ignoring Bailey completely, although the boy was standing beside him,
As you know, a certain discipline must be maintained in a school. A line must be drawn between teachers and students. We teachers would love to be one of the boys, of course, but that line of separation must remain. An invisible line, perhaps, but still there, is Moist.